Proudly supporting WHYY is New Jersey's Clean Energy Program, educating businesses, local governments, schools, and residents how to integrate energy-efficient and renewable technologies into their new construction projects, existing building upgrades, and new equipment installation. More information about modernizing facilities with assistance from New Jersey's Clean Energy Program at njcleanenergy.com/WHYY.
We've heard a lot about the Pope's visit to Philadelphia, but what's on the agenda before he arrives? I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. We'll learn about the World Meeting of Families, the impetus for the Pontiff's first ever visit to the United States. First, Delaware Senator Chris Coons says he will vote for the proposed nuclear agreement with Iran. WHYY's Nichelle Polston reports.
Delaware Senator Chris Coons says an Iran with nuclear weapons is one of the greatest threats to America. Coons says the proposed deal is the United States' best option right now.
I will support this agreement and vote against any measures to disapprove it in Congress.
However, Coons says the agreement does not mean the United States fully trusts Iran.
So let's be clear. No one could mistake Iran for a friend of the United States.
Coons concedes some weaknesses in the deal, but thinks international forces are more likely to detect nuclear violations if it's put into action. With Coons and Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey supporting the deal, the Obama administration is one vote shy in the Senate of ensuring it passes. From the Delaware desk, Nichelle Polston, WHYY News.
Along with this month's papal visit, Philadelphia is hosting the World Meeting of Families. The meeting is the main reason the Pope is coming to the United States, but what is the World Meeting of Families? WHYY's Tom McDonald spoke to organizers to find out.
You can break the 8th World Meeting of Families into three different parts. There's the Congress, the Family Festival, and also the Papal Mass for more than a million people on the Ben Franklin Parkway. Lizanne McGarity-Pando is Director of Marketing and Communications for the World Meeting. She says it's expected to be the biggest event of its kind ever.
The last conference was 7,000 attendees, and we're already up to 15,000 attendees. So we're delighted to be even double the number that it was in Milan 3 years ago. It's really just going to be an exciting, dynamic piece.
But the goal of this story is to tell you what is the World Meeting. McGarity-Pando explains it this way.
Talking about the family, strengthening the family, helping people stay together and not splinter apart. It helps your family, it helps your faith, and it also helps the world around you.
The first part of the event is broken down to the events for adults and youth. Mary Beth Yount is Director of Content and Programming for the adult portion of the World Meeting of Families. She says they're doing dozens of breakout sessions designed to help strengthen the family unit.
We have probably almost 140 speakers from around the world talking about how to improve in your relationships. It's all revolving around this theme of love is our mission, the family fully alive.
That includes how to keep the family together during trying times, looking at emotional and financial issues from the Catholic and interfaith perspectives. The sessions try to offer practical skills to make life better, covering dating, the blended family, honoring the elderly, the role of women in the church, and even benefits and obstacles of being an online family. The speakers are not just talking from a Catholic perspective, says Yant.
So we have presenters from all different denominations, from all different countries, coming to help people get practical skills for ways that they can grow in their life and in their relationships within their household, within their neighborhood, and as a global community.
Children's events are designed for those ages 6 through 17. Maria Richardson is the head of the Youth Congress. She says the goal is to entertain while educating.
They will be making Pope puppets of Pope Francis out of paper bags. So expect to see many Pope Francis puppets on the parkway when he arrives.
For the older kids,
we have Swing with the Sisters dance party that the sisters are providing. They'll be doing hula hoop contests and teaching line dancing. We have shooting hoops with the seminarians so that the young men can just kind of interact with them. We have Wii bowling with the bishops, and the bishops will be playing the Wii games with the high school students so that they can have some interaction there.
There will also be service programs that teach the concept of sharing and caring about those who are less fortunate.
One is Helping Hands, where they will be packaging rice and soy and food that will then be sent overseas to Africa. There's another one called Fill a Bag, Fill a Heart, where they'll be decorating a paper bag and then filling it with toiletries, washcloths, socks, and they will be delivered to some of the homeless around the Philadelphia area locally.
Once Pope Francis arrives, there will be the festival on the Parkway and two papal masses, an invite-only one at the cathedral on Saturday and the giant one for a million or more on the Parkway Sunday afternoon. To handle the crowds, the meeting is recruiting 10,000 volunteers to help. Suzanne Kinkel's job is to coordinate all those free workers. She says they're relying on co-sponsors to give them the best trained and personable people to deal with what could be some very trying issues with the massive crowds. Think about all those people waiting to go through metal detectors or the crowds looking to leave after the Parkway Mass is over.
We have certain corporate sponsors that we know, you know, will help us, and they know their people, you know, really well. So we'll put them in, you know, some what I call maybe some key areas for us where they'll help us manage the events.
Don't think just by volunteering, it's a ticket to get close to the Pope, says Kinkel.
So we've made it clear from the beginning that the role of the volunteer is to assist the 1.5 million guests that are, you know, coming. And we have, or we are working on a deployment plan as we speak that will place, you know, volunteers in what we call key areas.
She says training more than 10,000 volunteers is important to cover all bases, even if some call out sick for the once-in-a-lifetime event. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
The official poster for the Pontiff's visit is a painting of Pope Francis based on a picture taken by a photojournalist 2 years ago. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that that image is now at the center of a licensing fight.
The World Meeting of Families is marketing itself with an array of merchandise. You can get posters, t-shirts, coffee cups, paperweights, all emblazoned with an image of the Pope blowing a kiss. It was painted by a local artist named Perry Milo. He licensed that image to the World Meeting of Families, but he might not own the image himself. Photojournalist Franco Origlia snapped the picture of the Pope blowing a kiss during a ceremony in Vatican City in 2013. That photograph is licensed by Getty Images, which called Milo out. Under fair use law, it can be argued that an artist is allowed to appropriate another person's creation. But Milo's lawyer, Kurt Schroeder, is not making that argument. He says by the time he could make a legal case for fair use, the World Meeting of Families would be over, along with all of its merchandising opportunities.
You know, and unfortunately at times, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, the law has gray areas. And when you fall into those gray areas and you look at the other circumstances, situations called just to be resolved without pointing the finger or trying to figure out who did what, and this is certainly one of those circumstances.
Schroeder says he's in negotiations with Getty Images to find a quick resolution out of court. A representative of Getty Images was not available for comment. The Philadelphia Archdiocese says the artist assured them that the licensing rights had been secured when he signed the merchandising contract. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
The mayors of Rome, New Orleans, and Puebla, Mexico are headed to Philadelphia for an event tied to the Pontiff's visit. The International Mayors Forum will focus on the role of local governments in strengthening and sustaining families. The panel discussion takes place at LaSalle University September 23rd. Turning to this evening's headlines, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf's administration says it has completed the transfer of more than 1 million adult Medicaid enrollees into a single benefits package as the program expands to record numbers under the 2010 federal health care law. Former Governor Tom Corbett tried to create three different benefits programs in conjunction with his administration's embrace of the Medicaid expansion. But the federal government did not approve all of those changes before Wolf took office. Advocates for the poor had protested Corbett's plan. 91 degrees, humid, mostly clear skies on Independence Mall. It's 6:15. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. This evening's forecast, mostly clear skies, low 72 degrees, hot and humid tomorrow, and Wednesday, and Thursday, rather, high both days in the low 90s. Friday, partly sunny with a 30% chance of showers or thunderstorms, high 86. Saturday, sunny, high in the mid-80s, and ahead to Sunday. And Labor Day Monday, sunny, high each day around 88 degrees. Still ahead, from Thomas Jefferson to John Edwards, a look at the history of political sex scandals.
What is distinct to our time and would be very alien to theirs is the idea that you should confess to it, that you should talk about it in public.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Karen Treatment Center supports WHYY. Is someone you care about struggling, losing interest in activities they loved? Changes like these can be a sign of drug and alcohol abuse. As a behavioral health care and addiction treatment center, Karen helps families understand when professional help is warranted, offering therapies that restore wellness in body, mind, and spirit. A confidential assessment is available at 855-894-4325 or at karen.org. That's Caron.org.
You turn to WHYY for exceptional coverage of the day's events and exciting storytelling. As Philadelphia prepares to welcome Pope Francis, we're investigating everything from the cultural and historical impact to need-to-know logistics, what it means for the world, the region, the city, and you. In the weeks ahead, stay with WHYY for ongoing reporting on the Pope's visit and find all of our special coverage and online features in one place at whyy.org/pope in Philly.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. As dormitories fill up on college campuses, students are thinking about classwork and making new friends, while parents are mulling over bills for tuition and back-to-school expenses. And there are other concerns around campus that affect today's students and will define higher education in the U.S. for years to come. The Chronicle of Higher Education has published a major poll of college and university presidents' opinions on the future of post-secondary education. NewsWorks Tonight producer Kimberly Haas discussed the view from the top with Barbara Gittenstein, president of the College of New Jersey, and Kim Benston, president of Haverford College.
Dr. Barbara Gittenstein, Dr. Kim Benston, thank you for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
It's a pleasure to be here.
The study focused on presidents' attitudes on three topics, and one is financial sustainability. The other is the issue of college rankings and then student outcomes. The college rankings, it seems like everybody's got a poll now. Everybody's got something.
And almost all of them are what I call beauty contests. And I'm speaking from the perspective of an institution that does very well in those beauty contests. There are, however, some rankings that I think if you look at carefully, you can at least glean some useful data for the institution to go in the right direction. And for the most part, it's those rankings that help you look at outcomes, because that's where I think we're having the most problem in higher education. And if you look at the rankings, too, the worst of the beauty contests look only at inputs. That is, how good are the students when they come in? How big is your endowment? Those kinds of things. That doesn't really assess what you do while you're there or what happens to the student. How far does the student get? I think the area that higher education still struggles in is learning outcomes assessment. We've just not gotten very sophisticated about that.
The individual tracks of data can be illuminating. Private rating systems are an industry, and they are here to stay, and people like Barbara and I have to, in some sense, manage expectations without ourselves being caught up in managing our educational missions to the rankings. That would be a severe error.
If we could turn to the financial outlook for our higher education system. I mean, before the recession, colleges felt pretty at ease with their tuition increases. They were usually outpacing the rate of inflation. And then the recession hit, and colleges still had the need to raise funds. So what's the financial outlook now?
A lot of the literature talks about the tuition increase year to year without taking into account what's happened to family income. And that is, actually, family income has stagnated since about 2002. And so even before the recession, families were suffering. So what was happening is that whether you're talking about a private institution or a public institution, tuition costs and fees for students were eating up a larger portion of a family's annual income. And now we've hit a crisis with that. So I think that's part of the conversation that has to happen on campuses. And I think part of the president's job is to help the campus understand this is just not a viable way to continue, that if you've got a need, that you have to sometimes substitute, more often substitute than simply add. And that's a hard conversation on a college campus.
Oh, yeah, it is. Sustainability, that's not a word perhaps that was used as often within administrations of colleges and universities as it now is and ought to be. And it's not simply an immediate phenomenon. It's been a growing and emergent one. We live in a culture in which the divide in wealth and in earning has grown greater and greater, and that has an immediately mappable impact on our missions. We also provide a particular kind of service. And when we look at the nature of that service and the opportunities for productivity and efficiency, they aren't the same as they might be if we were manufacturing widgets or selling hamburgers. We have a completely different business model, as it were. We also have to keep our eye on our core missions, understanding what is our core mission and what we will sacrifice and what we cannot afford to sacrifice without losing contact with what we're trying to do and who we're trying to serve. But it is navigable. And I think that we are beginning to learn the tools for doing that in an era where we aren't going to have tuition increases of the sort that we saw in the 90s, for example.
And I think, actually, the biggest problem for higher education right now is not the economic problem. I think the biggest problem is the suspicion and skepticism of the public and public leaders about higher education.
Yes.
And some of the solutions that are being proposed by politicians, particularly, focusing on online education,
right,
focusing on competency-based education, focusing on community colleges, will drive those students with the greatest need financially to those choices and by definition make them less employable than those who go to the four-year
right.
colleges.
Right.
And so certainly over time, less employable.
It's a strangely elitist. It'll have a strangely elitist and classist effect.
That's
in
exactly
the name
right.
of the opposite. But our successes over the course of a lifetime are demonstrably and empirically outstanding in the liberal arts sphere. I don't mean just Haverford College. And that's the kind of thing that in the kind of panic of the moment, which is an understandable panic in the aftermath of the meltdown in 2008, 2009, people are worried about the simple act of employment, but you're not really taking into account the aim of our educational mission, which is a full lifetime success.
Yeah. Dr. Barbara Gittenstein, Dr. Kim Benston, thank you for coming on Newsworks Tonight.
Appreciate the opportunity.
Newsworks Tonight producer Kimberly Haas spoke with the presidents of the College of New Jersey and Haverford College. You can hear more of their conversation at newsworks.org. Political sex scandals in the United States are nothing new. They date back to the Founding Fathers. But the way politicians deal with those scandals has evolved. On this week's segment of That's History, WHYY's Chris Cetullo and Jonathan Zimmerman, professor of history at New York University, discuss the modern political public confession.
Welcome, Jonathan.
Good to be here as always.
As we so often do on That's History, we're going to talk about sex. In fact, presidential sex. What happened in the news that has you thinking about presidential sex?
Well, what happened recently is that DNA testing showed that indeed Warren Harding had fathered a child by one of his many mistresses, in this case, Nan Britton. And basically the descendants, the Britton and the Harding families, submitted to this testing and found out that they were related.
So it was a little blip on the news, but it had you thinking sort of about the different ways in which that kind of matter was handled in the past versus now in our CNN, Fox News, media-soaked environment.
Yes. I mean, as the Harding example shows and others that we'll discuss, we didn't invent these political sex scandals. But what is distinct to our time and would be very alien to theirs is the idea that you should confess to it, that you should talk about it in public. If you go back to our first great sex scandal, it involved Thomas Jefferson and a woman that he owned, Sally Hemings. In 1802, a frustrated office seeker, actually a former Jefferson ally, published in Richmond a series of articles about his relationship with Hemings. It got a great amount of media play.
Wait, but Thomas Jefferson found a way to ignore that or not to respond to that?
He absolutely did. He made no public mention of it. And in 1804, he was reelected in a landslide. The same goes for probably the second most famous political scandal of the 19th century, which involved Grover Cleveland. While Grover Cleveland was running for president the first time, newspapers reported that he, too, had fathered a child out of wedlock. And this became a major talking point for the Republicans, for the people behind James Blaine. Ma, ma, where's my pa? And, of course, after Cleveland won, the Democratic retort was, he's gone to the White House. Ha, ha, ha. Mm-hmm. Well, how did he go to the White House? How was he able to survive this? Well, back then, the way he was able to survive it was by ignoring it. He later gave an interview in which he said, we had to follow the policy of not cringing. It was the only way to go.
Moving forward into the 20th century, Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Dwight Eisenhower both, I believe it's known now, had long-term relationships with women other than their wives.
Yes, indeed. Roosevelt's for a longer period of time than Eisenhower's, which involved his driver when he was the head of NATO. But in Roosevelt's case as well, I mean, this was something that was well known by the press corps and indeed known by Roosevelt's intimates. But he didn't speak of that because that was considered unpresidential. You didn't air that kind of dirty laundry with your constituents.
So how do we get in a relatively short period of time, a couple of decades from that, to the Star Report, the blue dress, and it depends on what the meaning of is is?
I think there are a couple of things that happened. The first, interestingly, is the phenomenon of televangelism. It was only with people like Billy Graham in the 1950s and indeed the rise of the televised medium that we had these revivals pumped into our living rooms and bedrooms. And the most dramatic element of the revival is the confession. A decade or two after that, you have the rise of what I would call the secular confession, which is the afternoon talk show. So you put these things together, and what you see is a cultural shift in what's legitimate to air, literally and figuratively, in public.
So one of the key moments in this, and in the history of sort of modern political journalism, is Gary Hart, Rice, and Monkey Business.
Eventually, Hart had to admit it. You know, and there was no way that he couldn't address it. And I think that's more or less become the current state of affairs, you know, not just Bill Clinton, but, you know, John Edwards, Mark Sanford, Anthony Weiner. You can't not say anything anymore.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you. It was fun.
Historian Jonathan Zimmerman spoke with WHYY's Chris Satullo. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas, with help today from Alex Lewis. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Tomorrow's the first day of school in the Chester Upland District, and we'll have a report as classes begin with teachers working for free. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.